KJ No, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. Please introduce yourself and tell us what's important for our listeners to know about you and about your work.
Thank you, Ken. Delighted to be with you. I'm a journalist. I'm the special senior correspondent for the Asia Pacific for KPFA Flashpoints. And I've been focusing on the Asia Pacific, in particular what we call the Pacific pivot, or this escalation to war, for the last 10 years. This is a very, very critical issue. So that's been my major area of focus. I also write for Counterpunch, Monthly Review, Black Agenda Report, Dissident Voice, and various other progressive magazines. I focus once again there on the geoeconomics and the political economics. Geostrategics and the political economy of the Asia Pacific.
All right. Well, thank you for being here, KJ. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. And I want to start with some context for our interview. In part one of our series, we defined imperialism as an advanced stage of capitalism where the ruling classes of a few of the wealthiest nations dominate the rest of the world's nations and peoples in order to control and profit from their natural resources, their labor, and their markets. And in our last episode, we looked at how the U.S. was founded through settler colonialism and the genocide of indigenous peoples. And then we saw how the U.S. accumulated the wealth it needed to industrialize through slavery and conquest both within and outside its borders. Then we saw how the U.S. emerged as the world's dominant imperialist power after World War II, and eventually became the world's only superpower when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. But in this century, we are increasingly seeing a U.S. empire that is in decline, and the empire is now targeting China, Russia, and Iran as its greatest enemies. So today, we're going to focus our interview on what the U.S. calls its strategic pivot toward Asia, and especially on the relationship between the U.S. and China. And there's not a single day that goes by anymore without a corporate news story that bashes China or a pronouncement by a U.S. government official that demonizes China as the greatest threat to the U.S. and to the free world, whatever that means. So, KJ, why is the U.S. empire now targeting China as its number one enemy?
We have to understand, as you point out, the empire, the U.S. Empire and the global system that it dominates the world with was created out of an extraordinary violence. I think Vincent Bevins has done some good work on this, but we have to understand that the modern capitalist world order has been created out of extraordinary violence. And as this system starts to decline, it becomes more and more violent. Now, the key point that we need to understand is that the U.S. is at war with China, and it's actually escalating towards a shooting war. But as you point out, this has been a long time coming. What happened was that after the fall of the USSR, the U.S. wanted to lock up or lock in its gains. It wanted unipolar global hegemony. And very, very early in this process, China was marked out as the key competitor or enemy that it had to contain. I mean, it even goes back to the 1949, rise of China and the Vietnam War itself. The West has always seen China as a threat. And the threat that China has always posed is a threat of a viable alternative system that is not subjugated to the global neoliberal order. So starting around 2008, what became clear was that the triumphalism that the U.S. had been shouting from the rooftops that it was really the end of history and that there was no alternative, became clear that that was not going to be. You know, the socialist nations, China in particular, they were supposed to collapse or assimilate like the Soviet Union. And in 2008, it became very clear that the contradictions of capitalism were such that it was collapsing around its own ears. This is the referral to the 2008 financial crash. And what became very clear and obvious was that there was not only a viable alternate pole of development, a non-Western, non-capitalist model of development, but that it was outpacing and outmatching the imperialist center and creating, you know, different possibilities for the world. That's when this plan to take down China, you know, took on a very, very earnest tone. And that's when we started to see, quote unquote, the pivot to Asia and air-sea battle.
And can you say a little more when you say that there is a non-Western, non-capitalist model of development? Can you describe that a little bit? Because obviously there's huge debate about, you know, is China state capitalist? Is it socialist? Is it imperialist? So how do you see the nature of that non-capitalist, non-Western development?
Well, China is not socialist. It's not socialist yet. It is what we could consider to be a proto-socialist state. It's a state that is moving towards socialism, and they're very explicit about this. They say that, you know, within 30 years, we plan to create the beginnings of a socialist state for all our people. But anybody who's read even, you know, rudimentary Marx knows that you don't jump from feudalism directly into socialism. There is a process, an intermediary process, where wealth has to be accrued and the means of production have to be leveraged. And this involves a transition through capitalism. So China is undergoing a kind of state-controlled or state-planned dirigist capitalism, and it's creating the early signs of a proto-socialist state that it hopes to put into more concrete form within a few decades. So I think these questions about is China socialist or not, I think these are misguided. I think just on the most basic level, during the 40 years that the United States has waged endless war and seen, you know, the earning power of its working class flatline, China has brought 850 million people out of poverty. That's not an insignificant accomplishment. It has essentially ended extreme poverty, and anybody who has ever approached conditions of poverty knows what an extraordinary accomplishment that is. To end poverty and to create a healthy life expectancy that is already longer than the United States. Remember, in 1980, China was comparable to one of the poorer African countries. In around 2000, 20 years ago, its wealth was comparable to that of India. And now it's seven times wealthier than India. China is still a poor developing country. Its GDP is about one-fifth that of the United States. But when you go there and you live there, it feels like a wealthy, well-run, safe country that is a good place to live. And I think that's the kind of extraordinary difference that in the West we don't fully understand. Just one more example, and perhaps it's a trivial one, but China does have large gaps or large differences of income, but those differences have actually crested and are starting to come down. And China routinely punishes the capitalist elite, puts them in their place, if you will, in a way that's inconceivable in the West. That is, you know, on average, they execute 1 to 2 billionaires a year. Can you imagine if the United States were to, you know, execute Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos, you know, these people every year? You would have a completely different economic system. So I think that's very, very misguided in thinking that China is capitalist or even imperialist. Even that allegation of imperialism doesn't hold up. Of course, China is doing developmental work. It has its Belt and Road Initiative. And these are largely between 70 and 90% are infrastructure development plans with, for example, African countries, as opposed to the massive resource extraction that you saw during an imperialist phase and the neo-colonial, neo-imperial phase that we see right now.
All right, so let's go back to the strategic pivot to Asia. Where does that term come from, and how does China fit into that?
Yeah, so as I was saying, there was a Cold War triumphalism, and the U.S. really believed that they were looking at the end of history. Margaret Thatcher, you know, used the term, there is no alternative. I think, you know, the neocons used the term, the end of history, that everything was going to become capitalist and neoliberal. And Wolfowitz and the neocons wanted to lock up these gains, and they put forth this doctrine that they referred to as the essentially this became the project for the new American century, but at the time it was the Defense Planning Guidance Document, the PNAC, the DPG of 1992. So as we understand this opportunity, they saw this as an opportunity of a global unipolar hegemony. They came together, this group came together, the neocons and what were called the Blue Team in the 1990s came together, and they created the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which became the Bush Doctrine, which became the Obama Doctrine. And the Obama Doctrine was specifically included the pivot to Asia. The pivot to Asia, in its simplest sense, is an encirclement of China along the first island chain. It's surrounding China with 400 bases, essentially to take down China. Contemporaneous with this pivot was less often discussed, but very, very important military doctrine that was created explicitly to take down China, and this was called air-sea battle. Air-sea battle was the China equivalent of the Soviet-era air-land battle. NATO and the United States had a doctrine of war against the Soviet Union called air-land battle, and the China equivalent of this was air-sea battle. And one of the key elements of air-sea battle was to choke China off through its naval routes, in particular in the South China Sea. There's the Strait of Malacca, which is a tiny bottleneck, and then that leads out into the South China Sea, which is an archipelagic naval area. And the U.S. explicitly gamed out that it was going to choke off China through the South China Sea. And if they did that, this would essentially destroy China's economy. That's 77% of China's fuel and $5.3 trillion worth of goods travels through that. So the Chinese response to that was first to create defensive perimeters inside the South China Sea, and this is what they refer to as, quote-unquote, the militarization of islands. Essentially, the Chinese took some uninhabited rocks and raised the costs of military intervention for the United States in the South China Sea. The second project that the Chinese did, and this is very similar to the Long March, is that as they were being encircled, the Chinese planned a long overland escape route out towards other countries. This is the Belt and Road. And so this is the plan whereby China builds overland escape routes, primarily rail, but also some sea routes that bypass the bottleneck of the South China Sea, and they come out in the Indian Ocean and then towards the Persian Gulf, and also go overland all the way to Europe and towards Africa as well. So it's there's some big picture planning, and you know, this is a global chessboard that we're looking at, and the U.S. In distinction to that, has been engaging in what we call hybrid warfare. So hybrid warfare is, I mean, the simple fact is that the United States is at war with China. And war has a kinetic and a subkinetic or a pre-kinetic dimension. The kinetic dimension, of course, is nuclear war. The kinetic dimension is shooting war, which could very rapidly go nuclear. But prior to kinetic warfare, you have pre-kinetic and sub-kinetic warfare, and all of these can be categorized as hybrid warfare, which are the different tools of trade, economic war, tech war, financial warfare, cultural warfare, diplomatic warfare, color revolution that is also happening. So this is part of a much larger tapestry of strategies of containment and war.
And just to bridge what you're saying in terms of the hybrid warfare, in the first part of our series, we showed how the forms of imperialist control have changed over time. So, for example, prior to World War II, you know, there were colonial invasions and direct occupations of nations, many of which were eventually defeated by national liberation movements in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that won independence for their countries. And then they were then subjected to new forms of imperial control through neocolonialism, through neoliberal economic policies, regime change wars. And today we're seeing this hybrid warfare you're describing as one of the primary methods of control against not only China, but Venezuela, Iran, other countries as well, right?
Exactly, yes. So, as you point out, there were national liberation movements that tried to, you know, shake off the yoke of imperialism and colonialism. And across the world, these were brutally, brutally suppressed. I think the two key examples that we have to remember but are often forgotten are South Korea and Indonesia. Both of those countries had quote-unquote, capitalist order imposed on them through literal genocide. In the case of Korea, about one-third of the population of North Korea was wiped out. In Indonesia, millions were slaughtered. So the extraordinary violence that capitalism needs in order to impose itself is both evident but always erased. And then after this kind of extraordinary terror, you had the tools of soft revolution that were always backstopped by extraordinary violence. So the regime change coups of, for example, in Latin America of the 60s and 70s, Operation Condor, it always went hand in hand. The regime change and the soft power always went hand in hand with the threat of genocide. That possibility has never shifted. That has never changed. And we have to understand the imperial global elite would rather see the end of the planet than the end of their domination. But inside that, you know, there were some extraordinarily, skillful tools that were manipulated. One of this was media. So, you know, the U.S. has strengths both in military, raw military power, and economic power, but it also has the extraordinary powers of its media apparatus simply because of the, a century or actually centuries of capitalist advertising and indoctrination. So this hybrid warfare it has an economic dimension. The most obvious one that we can see is in sanctions. And at the current moment, about one-third of the planet, one-third of the countries of the planet are under U.S. sanctions. So they're, you know, being forced to buckle. Otherwise, you know, they will be destroyed. But of course, there are other tools such as tech war, financial warfare, in particular, you know, the destruction of a country's economy through financial means or by arresting and kidnapping, you know, people for various quote unquote financial or trade sanction violations. And of course, there's a large body of lawfare, legal warfare, that is also applied in conjunction with financial war and economic warfare. But I think the key dimensions that we have to understand are color revolution, which, you know, have essentially become the lifeblood of Western capitalism, you know, starting with the 1950s, Iran and onwards, or even earlier, Europe in the after World War II. But also, we have to think about the way in which information warfare and cultural warfare, these have kind of transformed the nature of the modern world and the ways in which ideology has been harnessed to bring around a fundamental orientation or fundamental belief in the inevitability of Western capitalism. This has been challenged by the Chinese model, first because the Chinese never allowed themselves to be assimilated into this Western model and this Western mode of thinking. At the heart and at the highest levels, the commanding heights of their economy, the Chinese are still Marxist. That's very, very explicit in their constitution, in the way that their political system, their political economy is structured, and in the actual execution of their policy. So because of this, the West constantly is ratcheting up the hybrid warfare, and we see this probably in the most visible and blatant way in the kind of information warfare, the propaganda against China, for example, regarding Xinjiang, quote unquote, this genocide that nobody can find any proof of, or in this WMD-type allegation that the Chinese created or spread COVID and therefore are responsible for the millions of dead around the world.
And I'm wondering what you see as the U.S. endgame here. I mean, if, for example, if these kinds of economic and legal and information warfare strategies are not successful, how seriously should we consider the possibility of a U.S.-China military war, whether it's conventional or nuclear? Is the U.S. seriously preparing for that? And to what extent is there bipartisan support for that kind of military warfare?
The first point to make is that the United States has already been at war with China at least two times. In 1950, during the Korean War, this was a proxy war against China. And of course, in the 1960s, in the Vietnam War, McNamara came out and stated, he said that, you know, our war against Vietnam only makes sense if we understand it as a war of containment against China. So remember, the U.S. has already been at war two times with China, and it is doing everything humanly possible to prepare for a kinetic shooting war with China at the current moment. You only have to go to CNAS, the Center for a New American Security, which is kind of like the Privy Council or Privy War Council for Joe Biden, to see the level of preparation and the very explicit tactics, the kind of on-the-ground operational preparations that are going for war. But the key thing that I would point out in this rise to war is, first, that this escalation to war is bipartisan. There's no lesser evil here. The imperial ruling classes cannot and they will not tolerate a rising or equal China in a multipolar world. They'd rather see the end of the world than an end to capitalism or white supremacy. There's one subset that believes that they can actually win a war against China or force its subjugation to the U.S. and the U.S. system. That's not going to happen. But if they can't have global ordered supremacy, they're not adverse to global disintegration. So one of the themes that we can also see is a kind of revolutionary disorder or chaos. So they plunge the rest of the world back into dark ages through hybrid and kinetic warfare, and the U.S. continues to control the key systems of communication, information, surveillance, finance, and of course, rent extraction. It's a rentier financialized system. And then, you know, there's a group of elite hawks that are millenarian Christians, and they are a minority, but they actually believe in heightening existing contradictions into Armageddon. So these people are also very dangerous. But the key point to remember here is that the U.S. is already at war. We're in a subkinetic and pre-kinetic phase, but we're very, very close to the threshold of actual war. And the U.S. no longer has overmatch in conventional weapons. The CNAS and the think tanks are coming up with a variety of very specific strategies to deal with China, in particular what they call the third offset. The third offset involves swarming and autonomous fighting. It involves, you know, AI-powered warfare. It involves subsurface warfare and long-range standoff technologies and hardware. Essentially, what we're looking at is the possibility of nuclear war. There's an entire generation of nuclear weapons that are considered, quote-unquote, to be usable in U.S. war doctrine. And since 2002, in the Nuclear Posture Review, the United States has explicitly prepared for nuclear war with China. And it has, a doctrine of creating intolerable damage in response to non-nuclear aggression. On the other hand, the Chinese have disavowed nuclear first strike. If the U.S. Continues on this pathway, we could easily see that the Chinese would have to shift to hair trigger or launch on warning, and that could result in the end of planetary life.
And how is this hybrid war and particularly the information war that's trying to manufacture consent, how is that fueling white and male supremacist violence and xenophobia within the U.S., particularly the violence we've seen recently towards, well, we've seen violence toward Asian Americans for a long time, but particularly the recent more public forms of it.
The white supremacy and its, you know, nicer euphemisms, manifest destiny, you know, U.S. exceptionalism, these are part and parcel of the imperial capitalist domination. And the key fact is that the United States always believed that it could keep its knee on the neck of China. When China stood up, that became a problem. And, you know, just as the United States has this vision or this paranoid threat inflation against any, you know, non-white minority that tries to lead, you know, an ordinary life, that actually tries to stand up, responds with, you know, massive violence, usually extermination. This is the same situation that we're facing right now. And so this rise to war, this hybrid warfare, a large part of this is information warfare to manufacture consent. And we know that this wholesale hate mongering and scaremongering against China, in particular, blaming them for, you know, the millions of dead around the world, and for, you know, perpetrating quote unquote this invisible genocide. This kind of scaremongering and hate mongering trickles down. This wholesale policy trickles down into retail violence on the streets, so that you start to see Asian Americans here in the United States being attacked randomly. This is a, you know, there's a kind of trickle-down effect of this wholesale policy violence. It trickles down into retail attacks on Asians. But this is a very frightening signal, because what it means is that the level of hatred, the, you know, this kind of daily 2 minutes of hatred against China has reached such a level that random attacks against Asians are both possible and legitimated. That lets us know that, you know, the fat is smoking in the pan, that we're very, very ready, we're very, very close to wiping out and engaging in kinetic warfare with China. If you can randomly kill Chinese on the streets over here, that means we're ready to kill massive amounts of Chinese over there.
And how has COVID been used to also fuel the hybrid war and anti-Asian racism?
You know, this is a really important question. The key thing is that when COVID first arose, the general framing was that this was a Chinese virus, it was a Chinese disease, and that this was going to bring down China. This was something that was created because China was so incompetent and corrupt and deceitful that it was perpetrating this kind of, you know, health catastrophe on its own people, and that it would not happen in the United States because the United States is transparent and clear and democratic, therefore it could never happen here. Well, that turned out not to be right. That switched rapidly. So then when you started to see this, these massive death tolls, and you saw how transparently the Western capitalist order was failing its people in the most fundamental sense, in the fundamental sense of keeping them alive and healthy, then this Schadenfreude switched into a vicious tactic of demonizing the Chinese and blaming the Chinese for the failures of the Western capitalist system. So the first COVID lie was that the Chinese had bioengineered this lab leak. And that was immediately debunked because there's nothing in the signatures of the genetic imprint that shows that it could have been bioengineered. And this was well debunked by the scientific community. That lie then switched to, well, perhaps they didn't bioengineer it, but they were doing some kind of mysterious gain of function research where the engineering would not be visible, or by sheer incompetence, they leaked it. And this lie has been re-weaponized at the current moment by Michael Gordon and Nicholas Wade, writing in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. But essentially, the Biden administration has ordered the intelligence communities to find out if China leaked this weapon, this virus. And of course, we have to ask ourselves, if you're trying to get the scientific truth of something, which the WHO is already doing, and they have ruled out the possibility of a lab leak. They say it's extraordinarily unlikely because that's just the pattern of zoonotic transfer. You know, we have hundreds of diseases that have been transferred from animals to human over the past century. But if you were serious about an investigation into the causes, you would appoint a scientific panel, not the intelligence agencies. But the intelligence agencies have been tasked within 90 days to come up with a determination whether China is responsible for COVID. And this is the same type of stovepiping and information warfare that we saw in the run-up to the Iraq war. That is, you know, this WMD allegation that was filtered and stovepiped through the intelligence agencies. We see this same process going on right now. In the scientific community, there's incredible dismay because they know that these are absolute lies. But remember, capitalist is never scientific or rational. It lives on superstitious irrationality, and right now that is the meme that has taken root. And I expect at the end of 90 days that we're going to find that China is responsible in significant ways for the massive deaths around the planet, and therefore that will be one more justification for attacking China and going to war.
Thank you for that, KJ. Let's pivot a little bit here, and let me ask you what thoughts you have about the importance of building global solidarity and anti-imperialist movements at this moment in history.
It's the most essential thing. We're facing probably one of the most dangerous moments, you know, in the modern era. And I cannot emphasize, you know, how close we are to war and how dangerous that war will be. We could see the end of humanity. But global solidarity is probably the only thing that can stop this machine. And in the global south, there's clearly an opposition to the United States. In the global center, in the capitalist centers, there is a kind of an elite consensus of war against China. There are some fractures inside that, but generally the global center, the hegemonic center, is preparing explicitly for war. And so then it becomes incumbent upon people here in the center to ally with people across the world, the working classes, who will suffer the most from this extraordinary escalation. We already are suffering. We see that in, you know, the weaponization of COVID. But essentially for us to imagine or envisage a future for the world, you know, we have to think about solidarity, and we have to think about solidarity on a global level, in particular among the progressive and socialist wings of the political classes. Without that, we don't really have a chance. Now, that said, you know, the danger or the difficulty that we're facing is that we have been so deeply indoctrinated into hatred and misinformation and irrational thinking. And, you know, this ideology of capitalist individualism, which is really the ideology, it's the ideology of the predator. The predator needs to divide and conquer. It needs the prey to think of itself as individual or individualized so they can strip them apart and take them down. And so we have to counter this, you know, not only with an understanding of solidarity and sociality and interconnectedness and global cooperation, but to really see through to the core of this, the kind of violent, aggressive selfishness, greed, possession, commodification that underlies the capitalist ideology. Once we start to strip that away, then we can start to think about meaningful ways of building cooperation and solidarity and working together in concert against this elite that seeks to destroy the planet and any meaningful alternative or alternative poles of development.
Thanks for that. Is there anything else you want to say that I haven't asked you about?
I think that, you know, I think the key message that we have to understand is that despair is not an option, that we're at a critical historical juncture, and we cannot buckle down or avert our eyes or put our heads in the sand. And the key thing that everybody can do in order to challenge this escalation to war is to understand that information war precedes, justifies, and enables kinetic war. And therefore, anything attacking China cannot be taken at face value, because these are a part of the information warfare. So I invite everybody, you know, not to take anything at face value, certainly not anything that I'm saying, but to evaluate it for source, evaluate it for logic and rationality, be very mindful about emotional triggers or trigger words, because that's how the propaganda works, and then look for what's missing. Look at the counter arguments, the counter evidence, and, you know, as we say in progressive circles, as we used to say, seek truth from facts. Watch out for memes and repetition. Watch out for invalid or compromised sources like Aspie or Adrian Zantz, or even some of the, quote, progressive elite warmongering media. And then speak up and call out the propaganda and the lies for what they are. We have to fight and challenge this escalation to war. And it's easier for us to challenge when it's still at the hybrid stage, when it's still at the information warfare stage. Once the machinery gains its full momentum, it becomes much, much harder. So don't allow yourself to be silenced. Be prepared to be criticized, but speak up, make your voice heard, challenge, organize. I invite people to go to peacepivot.org. This is an organization I'm involved in. They have some good resources. Also, Code Pink and No Cold War also have very good resources on debunking and challenging this imperial escalation to war.
And maybe we should also reference your article from last fall, the U.S. is set on a path to war with China. that was in Popular Resistance, Black Agenda Report, and probably some other places.
Counterpunch, Chow Collective, yes. Yeah, so the U.S. is set on a path to war with China. What is to be done? I map out the history, the context, the reasons for why this war is happening, and some concrete measures that we can take to prevent this from happening.
And in addition to those information sources, are there any organizations that you find especially inspiring or doing really good work around global solidarity and anti-imperialism?
You know, I think No Cold War is doing really brilliant work. I think the Gray Zone has probably some of the best analysis right now. It's certainly not subject to the kind of distortion and echo chambering that you see in a lot of the quote-unquote progressive media. And then I would say, peacepivot.org, we're also working on a kind of global and big picture level. So there are many, many good organizations, in particular No Cold War. And I think that the more we can ally and the more we can cooperate and coordinate, I think this can make a difference. It's not too late. Despair is not an option. We have to take action.
AJ, no, I so appreciate you taking this time to share your wisdom and your insights with us.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you.